What's up, family? You are tuned into Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. This is Resistance in Residence, where we profile artists using their gifts to change the world. This week's Resistance in Residence artist is Bay Area-based playwright Star Finch. Star, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Really excited to have this conversation. I've been watching you from afar until recently. I get to watch you up close, watching you sort of explode across the Bay Area, actually, which we'll get into in just a minute. I do have to, because of FCC regulations, state that I am currently in a production written by Star Finch called Shipping and Handling. But Star, I want to start with a bit about you and specifically where and how you grew up. You may have been offended. I said Bay Area. I think you're very San Francisco proud. And what your family was like.
Yes, I'm very San Francisco proud. I was born and raised in San Francisco. And my family was a trip. My mom was a former hippie. And my dad was, he was a San Francisco born and raised as well. He was more in the street life in his youth. And as he got older, he just was very much not so much a revolutionary in the streets, but very much a reader, self-educated, and really put me up on a lot of game through books, had conversations with me through the books that he would hand me rather than necessarily talking about things. I was always feeling like kind of a outsider, just as far as my family being so out of the norm. My mom always had me at protests. There's pictures of me in the strollers at protests. It was very much about boycotting certain things. I couldn't do a lot of things my friends were doing. And yeah, it was, I would say that it wasn't political so much in terms of like my parents being part of organizations, but it was political as far as teaching me from a very early age that, you know, the system was not to be trusted and that there was always, more to a story than whatever was shown, you know, on the news or in my textbooks at school type thing.
And how did that impact your worldview and even like your relatability or relations with other kids your age? Shift like how you navigated the world?
Yeah, I mean, I think if you talk to people that I grew up with, they would always say I was a little different. Just in the things that I would talk about, the questions that I would pose. When I was a teenager, I would aggravate some of my friends, you know, if we were smoking weed or whatever, and I would start talking about the stars and the galaxy, or if a topic came up about something going on socially, you know, they would jokingly say like, "Oh, Star is about to start preaching," you know, because I would just go off on something. So it was either they would see me as, you know, my sister and other people would call me science as a joke, and other people would just call me the preacher because I was always just sort of daydreaming out loud with whatever was coming in my brain. And at the time, I think I thought that maybe everybody thought similar to me, but just didn't talk about it. But it wasn't until I got older and really started writing and stuff that I would start to get feedback that was like, you know, your brain is different, or you know, you're on one, you're out there type of thing. But I think I often was just, I mean, I think being a Scorpio too, not to generalize, but I think Scorpios tend to be very much about truth and uncovering, you know, getting to the root of things. So that was very much in my makeup from an early age. And I would say mix that with the daydream, you know, just daydreaming about what else could be, what else is possible, what else are we not talking about?
When did you discover writing?
I would say that the first time that I saw writing as a tool was in high school, where I was going through a breakup, and my best homegirl at the time was going through a breakup. You know, these dudes were just dogging us out, and I had an assignment. And so I wrote the assignment as a story of us where we killed our boyfriends, and the paper was written. And the paper was written in red ink, and the big reveal at the end was that I was writing in their blood. And it was very much something to just cheer my homegirl up, like make her laugh. But, and my teachers were concerned. That was kind of pulled to the side. But I also got feedback that it was good. And that, you know, so that was the first time that I used it as sort of an emotional release. And then as a senior, I had a teacher, a creative writing teacher, who also gave me a lot of really positive feedback and told me I had a gift. But it wasn't really in my head that like writing was something that you could do or like devote your life to necessarily. So I put it down, and I went to Stop and Start to college, started, stopped, went to City College. Then went back to state, and for undergrad, I really got into anthropology, specifically like cultural and racial anthropology, and got a chance to go in the archives and get really deep into all the nonsense and madness that was passing as science during slavery and colonialism, and was really blown away by uncovering all of that. And then graduated and really put that down. And I got married young. I was going to be a stay-at-home mom. I was trying to get pregnant. It was taking a while, but I was always writing for myself. At that time, it was more like short story novella type things. And looking back, I was also still trying to process my sort of internal emotional stuff, but it wasn't as conscious. I thought I was just writing these characters. And I think really it was just about my soul and spirit feeling like there's more for you to do. You know, you're not really doing what you're meant to do, but I didn't have the language for that, or, you know, the space to really open that up or understand that my life belong to me, or that my life should be what I wanted to do. That wasn't really where my mindset was at for, you know, a number of different reasons. And my sister randomly invited me on a trip to Puerto Rico with her homegirl. And we went down there and we met people from out there who took us, you know, all behind the scenes out of the tourist areas into the more Black Puerto Rican areas in Loíza and Santurce. And I found myself, you know, watching the sunrise one morning on the beach, which already was upside down for me as a West Coast girl. I was so used to watching the sun set into the water. But here I was watching the sun rise out of the water. And I just heard this voice speak to me and said, you know, there's another life waiting for you. There's people that you're supposed to meet. And I didn't really know what to do with that, but that planted a seed in me to where when I got home, I got brave and I started to voice the things that I had been holding. And it wasn't all perfect and clean, like, you know, some movie. Like, it was very messy and emotional, and I was stumbling my way through it all. But, you know, I ended up going to therapy. I ended up opening up things that needed to be fixed within my marriage, also within my, you know, within my relationship with my mother, my sister type thing. And I also, for the first time, said out loud, I think I want to write. And so I applied to grad school at San Francisco State with the writing that I had been doing just, you know, on my own, in my notebooks. And And I ended up getting in. And initially I got in under fiction and was navigating, you know, workshops and that type of thing, because state was great, but state wasn't really that diverse. Or at least that program wasn't that diverse. So I was still bumping up against certain frustrations in how my work was being received, and the feedback that I was getting. And a lot of times, certain workshops would be full. So one semester, I needed another course. So I ended up taking this theater course that was ran by Michelle Carter, who's a playwright here in San Francisco. And she ended up becoming a mentor. And that class was just going to see theater and together as a class, and then, you know, coming back the next class and talking about it, breaking it down. And I had never really, I maybe went to like one or two things as a kid, to like field trips maybe, but I wasn't a theater person. I didn't really know too much about it. And so that just, a light bulb kind of went off in my brain again, because I realized that theater was really, it wasn't just about what was being said, that it was really about subtext, and that was what was holding the emotional charge of a scene, and, you know, just drama and secrets. And it just felt a lot more freeing than fiction had felt up until that point. So I ended up taking another class with Michelle, and soon after, you know, changing my focus or in my major from fiction to playwriting, and really blossomed under, you know, her direction. And even after I graduated, I was pregnant and during grad school, and took some time off and came back and finished. And she was kind of worried about me just not doing anything as a new mom. So she invited me back, you know, like a year later, to just audit another workshop with her so that I could keep working on stuff. And I wrote a script in that workshop that I audited, and she suggested that I apply to Playwrights Foundation's, you know, their contest every year. And I ended up making it as a finalist, which was huge. That was like the biggest thing in my world. It was like the only thing I had on. And again, you know, things just happen from connections. Like, I was friends with DJ Wanway, Juan Amador, from a hip hop collective that we were a part of, and he had gotten into acting, and I had gone to support him just as a friend. And so when I announced to sort of our group chat, like, you know, hey, I made it a finalist to this thing. I wish I was telling y'all that I won it, but I just wanted to share. And he was like, okay, I'm gonna talk to the group I've been working with, which was Campo Santo. And so he asked Sean, if Sean San Jose, if I could come through to, you know, one of their workshops. They had a lab called Clica that they were starting up. And after some prodding and convincing, Sean San Jose was like, sure, you know, let her come through. So I came, and I shared my pages, and slowly, you know, would just come. I think back then we were doing it like every 2 weeks. And I was like, I'm so happy to be here, because it's, you know, it can be lonely as a playwright if you're not plugged in with a group. You're just kind of on your own. And I was just so happy to be part of a community. And after a while, Sean was just like, okay, you know, that's cool, but what else you got? So we, you know, each person could bring in 5 to 7 pages. And throughout that process, I ended up writing the first draft for my play Home, Hookers on Mars, eventually. And I really just became part of the Campo Santo family, and never left. And everything else has really sprouted from that.
And the world of theater will never be the same in many amazing and beautiful ways. Straight facts. You kind of already answered this question, or you started it, I think. There's like nuggets of it in what you've already said. But what worlds did writing, playwriting in particular, open up for you? And I don't mean necessarily like, right, I was able to connect to this person, that person. I mean like spiritually, psychically, politically, emotionally.
Yeah. I mean, I think it opened me up to myself, which shifted everything, you know, in my world. And it allowed me to trust my voice and to trust my imagination. Home, that came out of my frustration of just watching the city that I knew and loved sort of totally transform from gentrification. And I had come across an image of two sex workers in Hunts Point back east. And this photographer had brought like a university grade telescope out onto the streets where he was photographing out there. And these two women were like looking through this telescope, and something about their body language just captured me. And I felt like, what are the odds of these two women ever getting to go to Mars? And why would these, you know, tech guys, what makes them, you know, so much more worthy type thing? And that was also like when homelessness started. I mean, there was always homeless, but it really started to become more visible. And I was just really reflecting on how it's like, if you don't have a phone or a computer and internet, you're really locked out of this new world that was being built. And, you know, what would stop them from one day locking us out of water, you know, or air if you're on another planet and you didn't pay your bill type thing? So it was allowing me to look at the now and reimagine how, you know, how that might look in the future. Because the thing is with, like, as you know, with colonialism and capitalism, like, there is no imagination whatsoever. It's the same song over and over again. We're caught in this repetition. And anytime that you sort of look under the covers of any new innovation or the new world or the new transformation, AI, whatever it is, it's always theft under there, theft in some form, sort of labor law violations, if not outright slavery in some format. So I would say that, you know, writing just really helped me be unafraid to see what I saw and to name it and to try to find ways to not so much decorate, but just sort of rearrange the information in a way that someone else could catch it, who maybe, you know, isn't reading a lot of books or is busy or, you know, whatever the case may be, that they can catch it too. Like, you have to really transmit the signal where anybody can catch it, because that's who the signal ultimately belongs to. And it's like, I have another play, Bondage, which takes place during slavery. And I set it on an imaginary island, because I feel like when you say slavery in the United States, all these sort of cliches immediately come to mind and we think we know what it is. And I gave it an Afro-surreal tilt to it, because I wanted it to just feel off in some way. Like, I feel like we're taught slavery as history, but it's really a horror film, like in every way imaginable. So I had like a lot of ghosts and violence and, you know, the slave masters are killed at the end of it. But it was really about me saying, you know, they don't tell us the truth now. So why would we believe that we know the whole truth about the past, that we really have an accurate picture or assessment of what went down and how it went down? Because we know they don't tell us the truth. So why am I trusting that? So I felt like, okay, given all that I've studied, you know, in college about slavery, and given my own intuition, I'm going to just write my own story. And I'm going to say that it's going to be just as accurate, if not more accurate, than anything else that, you know, has come out over the years. And why not? And that was that, you know, as far as like opening worlds, bondage, I was, you know, I had a reading, I had a draft, I was trying to get to another draft to get to rehearsals. And I felt like the ending just wasn't doing what I needed it to do exactly. And I didn't know what it was. I was kind of panicked, but I was just like, you know, it'll come to me. And that play was one specific experience where I woke, like I woke up in the middle of the night. I want to say it was maybe like 3, 4 a.m. And I always keep my notebook and pen by my bed. And something literally just came to me. Like I was writing. I wrote Until the Sun Came Up. It was like two different scenes. And I was just, you know, almost note-taking. Like it was just pouring out of me through my hand onto the page. And that was an experience that really stayed with me, because I, by the time it was over, I was just like, you know, like what just happened? Mm-hmm. but I trusted it, you know? So I think that the gift is really about opening my imagination, being able to trust my voice, and feeling that my work then is to find ways to use my voice to help other people unlock their own imagination in deeper or richer ways than they already are.
When you said, my life belongs to me, I had this twinge in me. And immediately my head said, Kat, your life belongs to the people. And then my next thought was, right, like, particularly for Black women, we aren't told that, right? We're not told, you know, the world is an oyster. it's yours to eat. I mean, I've worked really hard with my daughter to be like, yo, if you want to go do calligraphy in the mountains of China, mm-hmm. bye, mm-hmm. you know. How healing was that for you? Like, what programming got to be reset?
Yeah, I mean, for me, that was really, it was a really deep childhood wound. And not to like get all into my family, you know, underwear drawers, but I just had a lot of trauma from a very early age. And that trauma, you know, I was asked to keep certain secrets. And so that really formed my, and that was like when I was like four and a half, five. So at the age where you're, you know, human development, you're supposed to be sort of coming into your body and realizing that you're an individual and, you know, this is your life, this is your body. I was very much programmed with more of a older sister protection mode, how to help, you know, keep the family intact or running mode. There was just all this dysfunctional stuff programmed in me from an early age that really, I wasn't in my body for most of my life. You know, I was, which I think also played into becoming a writer. I was very much observing things a lot of the time. I was not at all embodied. And so that, you know, played out in relationships. That played out in who I thought I should be, you know, what it meant to be a wife, that sort of thing. And so when I say realizing that my life was my own, it's really about just becoming embodied and realizing that everything, I think, you know, we learn this as older sisters, you can learn this as mothers, especially. You can lose yourself, right? In trying to like care for everyone else. And also when there's dysfunction, you're not only caring, a lot of times you're like anticipating what other people need or trying to read the energy vibes in a room and trying to stop something from happening or helping something else happen. And so realizing my life was my own was for the first time, literally, you know, in my mid-20s of being like, wait, what do I want? I never really sat with that before. It was always like, what's best for my family, what's best for my husband, what's best, you know, for my friends type of thing. And it was a deprogramming, or just, it was a process. It was not overnight. I mean, this was like therapy. This was a lot of, you know, starting and stopping, slipping and falling, but slowly just reclaiming my own agency to say, oh wait, yeah, what do I want to do with my life, you know? And that sounds so basic. And like you said, I'm the same way with my daughter. I'm 100% like, what do you want to do? If you feel a way, speak it out in the world. You know, you don't have, you know, I don't talk to her about like, oh, when you have kids or when you get married. I'm always like, if you want to have kids, if you want to get married, like I give her all the agency that I can, because I didn't get that. And I think it's very important. I do, you know, I do think that ultimately, yes, we have to be living for the collective. I'm not on some like American, you know, exceptionalism. I'm going to tune out everything and it's just about me. But I didn't even have that first step of like embodiment and understanding who I am so that I could best be in service to the people around me and my greater community. And I think that, you know, that goes for anybody, but especially women. When you're not locked in with yourself and who you are and what you know and holding boundaries, it's so easy to just drown, you know, in the needs and wants of those around you. So that was huge. That was a huge step for me. Even though it sounds small, it was the step that led to everything else.
It don't sound small to me at all. She says as she fights back tears. And what a blessing. I mean, you said in your mid-20s, you know, I am taking the first steps of this walk in my late 40s. But one of the things that gives me hope about particularly our folks is it's just each generation. It's just light years.
Yes.
You know?
I love it.
It's like we just see like all of the, you know, our elders' work, our ancestors' work, our, you know, my generation's work. Like it's just, as devastating and demoralizing as it can be to just read headlines or do this show Monday through Thursday. like when I really listen, you know, to her, younger folks, I'm like, phew, okay. Yeah. Things actually might just be better than okay.
Yeah.
Or getting to be in the room, because now I have to move on to talking about the current show, like with this brilliant cast of Black humans in the show Shipping and Handling that is going up at Crowded Fire Theater. Opening night is August 12th. I don't think there's like a log line for this show that would do all of it justice, because there's so much in it. But do your best, Star. How would you describe Shipping and Handling for the people?
Well, in its basic form, Shipping and Handling is presented as a night out in the theater told in reverse. So normally you would go see a show, you know, opening night, there's a little talk, you know, there's a talk back after the show, and then the actors party. I'm saying that in order for me to get you ready for this AI vision, this Black AI vision, I'm going to mess with time and I'm going to move us backwards. So for this show, when you come out, you'll see the actors hanging out at their after party, and then we'll experience a talk back by the playwright, who she's doing it on her own terms. It's not your normal talk back format. And then we enter into the play within the play, Indigo, which is about a Black scientist, Dr. Mother Mercy, and her holy robot named Indigo. But I mean, that's the structure of it. But really the intention is about gathering folks in the dark together and plugging them into different experiences that will allow us to really feel and measure what it means to be human beings in general, but also in this very specific moment where we're being given this AI push 24/7. We're definitely in the belly of the beast here in San Francisco. This is where all the tech companies are based that are not only flooding us with AI across all industries, but are also programming and doing all the dirty work of these drones and smart bombs that are dropping in Gaza 24/7. So it's the realest of real times to be having these conversations, to be holding these ideas together. And hopefully, I really hope audiences come out the theater and take a breath and really start to look around and question things a little more for themselves around AI and tech and this world that we're zooming through that really needs to end, you know.
And it is a word. It is many words, y'all. And it is opening at the Magic Theater at Fort Mason on August 12th, runs through September 7th, Friday, Saturday, and Sundays. You can learn more or get tickets at crowdedfire.org. Star Finch, thank you so much for spending this time with me.
Thank you. I'm so happy you're in my show, too.
I'm so happy you're in your show, too. Y'all are listening to Law & Disorder. I'm your host, Kat Brooks. We have been speaking to playwright Star Finch, who is this week's Resistance in Residence artist.
You've been listening to Law & Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. That's it for this episode, family. Law & Disorder is produced at KPFA. That's listener-supported radio on the Pacifica Network. The show is produced by Jesse Strauss and hosted by me, Kat Brooks. Our theme music was composed by Steve Raskin of Fort Knox 5. Our Resistance in Residence theme music was composed by Jesse Strauss. If you like what you heard, please follow us on social media at Law & Dis and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. You can also find our content live at 8 a.m. weekdays on KPFA. That's 94.1 FM in the Bay Area. Our show and all KPFA's programs are funded exclusively by you, the listeners. If you're in a position to support us, please donate today at kpfa.org. Take care of yourself and take care of each other. We all we got, fam.